RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Eric Crampton is the Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative, New Zealand's leading think tank. He's previously been here on this program discussing the government's housing policy and the digital bargaining bill. That was back in July. Dr. Crampton is back with us to talk about two, well, actually very serious issues: declining fertility rates and why in a global survey we rank last, that's right, last for infrastructure delivery. Eric, thanks for coming back to RCR.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with declining fertility rates. We've known about this for quite some time, though it's really showing up all over the world, right? This is global.
It sure is. So this isn't an area of my specialty, but it's one that I got to participate in a couple of weeks ago. So Fertility Counts had a session at Parliament where they had one of their experts talking about the decline in fertility rates. And I'd missed the very sharp, very recent decline in New Zealand's. There has been this long-term decline. There's been a more recent, very sharp decline since 2014. It is global. They had a panel session on this. So Sarah Hogan and I were both talking on it from the economic side. And then they had the fertility people talking about it from sort of the medicine side. But typically you expect that a population will be self-replacing if you have a fertility rate of about 2.1. So if every woman has about 2.1 children, then things turn over. We're down to about 1.5. And that's well below replacement rates. Other countries have dropped further. Korea is below one, or South Korea anyway. I'm not sure what the stats are worth in North Korea, but South Korea is below one now.
They never tell us for a start, would they? They never give us those figures anyway.
Yeah. So they're below one. Otherwise, New Zealand is comparable
below
to Australia.
Below one.
South Korea has gone below one. We are comparable to Australia at around 1.5. It's potentially a problem, depending on how you look at things.
What do you mean potentially? It sounds like there could be an upside, but
I hate to see upsides or downsides in these sorts of things, because to me, they're not something that governments should really target. The outcome of intensely personal decisions that couples and individuals make, right? And just think about the horrible things that would have to be done if the government wants to target a higher or a lower number, right? So when China was trying to decrease its fertility rates, it committed atrocities. Now China's turned around and they want to encourage higher birth rates, and they're not being quite as interventionist as they were on the other side of it, but they are doing things like sending people to or government officials to people's houses saying, okay, you're recently married, getting to work on the first kid, how are things going, can we help with that?
The nudge unit.
Well, it's a little more intrusive than I'd feel comfortable with. It's not really the government's business, but some of it is a consequence, I think, of poor policies around housing, but it's going to be fairly minor relative to sort of the big picture around changing opportunity costs and changing economic circumstances. So those big picture trends are pretty hard to do much about. It would be pretty illiberal to go and try to do something about them, but we can at least try to make sure that government isn't unintentionally standing in the way of people getting towards their desired family size.
Yeah, though our job as humans is not to end the species, is it? I mean, the fundamental job is to keep it going. And if we're not, whether it's economics or whatever, we're going backwards, because who's going to pay the taxes? Who's going to look after the aging population? How do we maintain, you know, our culture as we know it?
With
no replacement.
Cards on the table, like I'm really pro people, right? So for a long time from the 50s through the 70s, there started being this argument that more people, more problems. The arguments are that we were going to run out of everything and we were going to have starvation. And you can remember the old movie with Soylent Green where we were eating people because that's all the resources have run out. That is all nonsense. That's not how the world works. That's not how economies work. More people means fewer problems because you've got more minds working to solve them. The natural constraints imposed by nature and resource scarcity, well, we find new ways of coming up with recipes for using things. new technology, right? More people that are working on this, the more developments we can have. What takes one Norman Borlaug to figure out new ways of running fertilizers that you can double world population, right? So a lot of people got to exist because he figured out synthetic nitrogen fertilizers and how to properly use them. So too many people was never really the problem. We could run into problems going the other way.
So when you say opportunity cost, that is to those making a decision on whether to have a family or not. The opportunity cost is missing out on a career. Is it? Is that what that means?
Well, it's a mix of things, right? So if we think back to the earlier era, there have been lots of things that have changed over the past century and a half. For one thing, sharp reductions in child mortality rates that mean that you can have a higher number of successful adult children who might potentially give you grandchildren with a smaller number of children that you've given birth to because fewer people die in infancy or in early childhood. That's all to the good. To that extent, reductions in childbearing because they're resulting in the same completed family size at the end, that's all fine. I don't think anybody should worry about that. The other changes in tech, though, well, in the earlier era, basically you had to have at least somebody half-time at home for the house to even work, tending the fire, right? Laundry was an all-day affair rather than put it in the machine and then deal with it when you get home. All of that meant that the opportunity cost of having another child was pretty low because somebody was going to be home anyway. And if you're primarily agrarian, then more kids on the farm, well, once they get above age 7 or so, they're actually helping rather than being a hindrance. So that was a very different environment. The changes since then, the opportunity costs are much higher. So with laudable changes in improving career prospects for women, 100 years ago, a lot of careers were just completely shut out. It was fundamentally illiberal and bad, but it's meant that having a highly successful career now often means delaying childbearing until your 30s, and that's when you're in a period of sharply declining fertility rates. So it's much harder to have 2 or 3 kids if you're starting much later, unless you want to go to assisted reproduction.
Yeah. The thing about that, though, is that it's an economic constraint more than a biological constraint, isn't it? And we've set up our way of working and obviously trying to offset the problems with childcare, but that only just puts your children with other people. It sounds like it may be at a point where we need to kind of reinvent the opportunity cost equation.
There's a wonderful piece by Justin Wilfers and Betsy Stevenson where they just try and explain some of the changes in women's work and then how people partner up over the past several decades. The piece came out in the mid to late 2000s. In that prior era, when you had to have somebody at least half time at home, people would partner up kind of on complementarity in production, where somebody's going to be really good at working outside of the home and make money, and the other one's going to be pretty good at in-the-home work. When people would couple up on that basis, you got a different dynamic than when you're coupling up based largely on the things that you enjoy together, because you're able to enjoy a lot of leisure because home production takes care of itself to a much larger extent than it used to. Hmm. That also then means, though, that the opportunity cost of children can be higher if you're foregoing more of those fun leisure activities, because like international travel starts being within the budget of working people if they don't have kids. If they do, then it gets pretty hard if you're trying to buy airfares for children at the same time. So those opportunity costs go up in that way. Also, other changes in the labor market. This was well put together by Claudia Golden, who got the Nobel in Economics in 2013-2014. So in her presidential address at the American Economics Association, she talked about this, where labor market changes in some careers meant that if you put in 80 hours a week rather than 40, you wouldn't be getting twice as much in earnings. You'd be getting 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much in earnings. So there are some careers where, like if you're in a high-powered legal or accountancy kind of team where your client wants to talk with you because you're the one who knows everything about their case and you can't just shunt it off to somebody else, your constant availability is worth an awful lot. Other careers, you can step out of them for a while, come back without as much of a loss. But those ones will not pay as much because people are naturally just more substitutable in those kinds of careers. That's then meant, though, that attaining really high earnings requires specialization in those kinds of areas, which again means higher opportunity costs for kids, that it's you give up more, or it's harder to get onto that track unless you're further along in your career and you're still foregoing a fair bit.
It's very selfish, isn't it?
Well, I'm just trying to give the positive analysis of how we think the world works rather than how any of this should be. Like, we've got two kids. I think they're awesome. I favor more kids.
Yeah, I've got three, and part of the deal was one of us stayed at home, and some of the time it was me, okay? Yeah. So that can work, and I know other countries try this. So getting back to the opportunity cost equation, is there any way, well, there would be, we can take taxpayers' money and we can supplement one being at home in a quasi-job, let's say, to make that possible, because otherwise it's a very shallow world, isn't it? The other thing is, too, the contraception's so available, and okay, that's fair enough. That's how things evolve. That's technology, et cetera. And I guess, you know, that's there for people to use and take advantage of.
Yep.
But it's so easy, even when you get a pregnancy now, to dispose of it.
Well, people have an awful lot more choices. They've got more ability to direct their lives as they like. That does result in fewer children than we had in the prior era. I like more children, but I wouldn't take people's choices away from them.
Or no incentivized choices, though. Not take them away, but incentivize options, because it's a natural thing to want to do. And I think many women, and we've talked to experts about this, many women regret not doing it in the end and look back on their high-powered career. And that is one of their greatest regrets for many.
And would be for some men, too, if they would take the option to be at home. But that's fewer men take up that option.
Yeah,
when you're getting into notions about paying people, Australia's baby bonus was in place for a period. It did increase birth rates, but they're back where we are now. It also was pretty successful in changing the timing of births, because the baby bonus only came into effect in July of a particular year. I can't remember the year now, but Josh Gans and Andrew Lee, who's now in Parliament, they'd done some work showing just this massive slump in births in the month leading up to the baby bonus eligibility, and then this huge spike right afterwards. So people were kind of timing things to the extent that they could.
Yeah.
If you're going to have one anyway, well, maybe just wait until you're going to get those extra payments. But they're in the same spot that we are. And really, if we're trying to improve the basic economics for families, you can try shoving it through taxes and pay people, but that's going to be really expensive. We've made housing so expensive, right?
Okay, well, there you go. Yeah, good point.
And it used to be that you could buy a house on maybe four times median household income. More lately, it's been like nine times median household income. You haven't got a lot left after housing costs and taxes to be able to afford to raise a family. That's a problem. And then you've also got ECE costs on top of that. So that was one bit from the panel session at Parliament that I hadn't been aware of. Like, I knew that ECE costs here were high. So I'm not talking about like the total costs are high. The government subsidizes a lot. You get the 20 hours free. But the out-of-pocket cost, one of the other presenters, I think it was Sarah, had put up a chart showing that the out-of-pocket costs wind up being pretty much the highest in the developed world, or at least of the set of countries that she'd put up. Now, since the government subsidies are fairly generous, I would be looking less at the extent of the subsidies and more at the what the hell have we done to make it so expensive to deliver childcare in this country?
Yeah. Any ideas on why that is?
Well, one of the presenters talked about regulations that came in that kind of killed off voluntary childcare arrangements, where in the church, the church had been offering a service where it is a beautiful sounding thing, right? So you had older people whose kids had gone off overseas and they hardly ever got to see their grandkids. And they would come into the church, and then people who'd come here and whose grandparents were overseas and their kids didn't get to see their grandparents that often would come in and use that service. So people who were wanting more, old people who wanted to spend more time with kids matched up with kids who needed to spend more time with old people, and it all worked out on a kind of a voluntary basis. But it was coming under the government's requirements on trained teachers and the like, and it ended up killing the whole thing. Now, I don't know how pervasive that is across the more informal and voluntary side of early childhood education, but you sure don't want to regulate that out of existence, because I would trust a grandmother who's had a whole pile of her own over somebody who's just finished off an ECE degree.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's sort of making an industrial process more than anything, isn't it?
Well, it frees up options. So if people are worried about, oh my God, if I have a kid, I will be foregoing my career, that's a really hard choice to make people make, and it will result in a lot fewer kids than otherwise. If it's possible to complement work with having kids in ECE, then you might have kids that you otherwise wouldn't have thought you could. But if we make ECE so expensive that that can't happen, well, you're stuck again.
The event you're talking about, was there any talk about the health of people? Because this could be at play as well. We're not as healthy as we used to be, nutrition-wise, diet-wise, ultra-processed foods everywhere. Obesity is, you know, an ongoing and growing problem. All sorts of issues that can also impact on fertility. Was there any talk about that?
There was less on that. Some of the IVF doctors there were noting that there are restrictions in eligibility for publicly funded IVF, in vitro fertilization, so government subsidies for assisted reproduction. There are health checks on that. If your BMI is too high, then you're not going to be eligible. And they wanted the eligibility for subsidies extended. I was more interested in, well, that people could afford to make the choice to have their families when they were still in periods of higher fertility. So one of the stats that was just bothering me in that one was what they'd put up: if you want a 90% chance of having a kid without assisted reproductive technology, you've got to start by age 32. If you want a 90% chance of two kids, you better start by age 27. But in 1991, 72% of people aged 30 to 34 owned their own home. By 2018, only 51% did. It is miserable trying to, renting is miserable during a housing shortage. If the housing market were working fine and everybody could build and there are lots of landlords competing for tenants, you'd be able to get stable tenancies and multi-year leases. When you're in massive shortages, it's precarious, and that can be a hindrance to having kids. If you don't have if half of the population doesn't have a house by the time they're starting into that sharper decline in fertility, well, to me, that starts explaining some of it, although I'd have to pull back a bit because it is international and not everywhere has New Zealand's housing shortage. It's one of the things that we could do to make things less bad than they are, though.
All right. One thing's for sure, though, we do need to at least replace ourselves, don't we? That is a very pressing thing, it seems to me.
Well, we're certainly looking at global population decline, and I don't like that because I think more people, more better, right? I don't think
there always
seems
to be enough room.
Population is not a problem. Pardon me?
There always seems to be enough room, you know, and that's what I'd say to people who are thinking of having kids but are scared off by what they see, is that the world makes room.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember is there have been some cultural shifts that economists have talked a little bit about. So there was a book by Brian Kaplan about a decade ago called Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids. And I think this was part of his lobbying effort with his wife about why they should have a larger family. And I think they got four or five now. But he was arguing that a lot of people seem to feel an expectation that they have to invest immense amounts of time and effort into their children. Otherwise, their kid is going to wind up a delinquent and on the streets and just bad things happen. He was arguing that, well, really, the data doesn't support that. You can do tremendous harm to a kid by abusing and neglecting them. But once you get to a basic, decent standard, spending your whole life driving them to and from 50 different things, you're just going to make yourselves, you and them, miserable. You could have more fun with them, play games with them, do the things that you like with them, and then it's not so much of a cost as an opportunity.
Or get them to ride a bike or take the bus, because that's what we used to do. All right. Want to get on to infrastructure before we're done on time. And many of our listeners probably aren't surprised to hear what I mentioned at the beginning, that New Zealand ranks last for infrastructure delivery in a global survey. What was the survey? And why do you think, because we used to do well on infrastructure, I remember, we used to build dams and railways and all sorts of things, and we seemed to get them done, and they worked, and they've been good for New Zealand, in the service of New Zealand. So why are we so down there now, Eric, do you think?
Well, I haven't seen a time series on this survey. It's an international survey, but it's about people's perceptions of how good their infrastructure is. New Zealand did pretty poorly on that perceptions measure, but there are a few things in there that seemed weird. So India came ahead of the Netherlands and was in one of the top spots for people saying that we've got really great infrastructure. Now, if you're going on holiday, in which place would you drink water straight out of the tap?
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Well, I've been to India recently. I avoided food poisoning, but I wasn't drinking water out of the tap. In the Netherlands, I wouldn't be worried about it. So it is based on perceptions, and perceptions depend on your expectations. That said, the survey pointed out infrastructure for supporting housing as being sort of the last ranked, and they're not wrong on that. So there was some work recently by the Infrastructure Commission looking at just how expensive it is for New Zealand to put up different types of infrastructure and how we compare internationally. I like that over perception surveys because at least it's grounded in something real. I never know with the perception survey whether people are just angry about it because it's been in the media a lot, or their expectations are unrealistic, or they've identified something real. So the Infrastructure Commission's work suggested that New Zealand isn't universally bad at infrastructure, but it is bad at one kind of infrastructure. We are bad on costs for basically horizontal infrastructure. Anywhere where you need to run a strip of land to do something in sort of a line, we wind up having trouble. So from tunnels for roading or rail or putting up new urban motorways or new rural motorways, we're pretty expensive, and especially for tunneling, it's just crazy expensive. On the other side, our wind turbines here cost as much as like the OECD international averages or a bit below to put up a wind turbine. So they were seeing there that, well, for wind turbines, you're not having to deal with the complicated consenting of these really long horizontal infrastructure projects. It's more site contained, but also we're just sticking up lots and lots and lots of wind turbines, and people get good at doing things that they do over and over and over again. So consenting processes learn how to deal with it, and they go tech, 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 tech. They know how to deal with it. People who build the things know how to deal with it. The people who import the things know how to deal with it. The workers, they're used to doing it. It just keeps rolling out again and again. By contrast, when we try and do these big infrastructure projects on horizontal, government usually is a terrible client for those kinds of projects. They don't quite know what they want until they've done the first round of contracting, and then they change their mind on it three times, and then the costs blow out, and then you're in a nightmare scenario. So one of the lessons was try and do things that are more repeatable and know what you want before you try contracting for it.
And it does seem, because many people have mentioned to me, that what is being put in place seems to take forever to do. You know, it just goes on and on. Wellington's a good example of that, you know. You'll have a road restricted for over a year, you know. It never stops.
Yeah, one of the council planning people that I talked to sometimes, not at Wellington Council, but at an adjacent one, had suggested that it could be done a lot faster if you just shut the whole road down for a period and got the thing done, but that people expect there'd be greater opposition to shutting the road down for a couple of weeks than to having it at impaired capacity for an extended period.
I saw a video recently, I'm sure people have seen the same video, and I think it was in the Netherlands. They put in a bridge, a whole new bridge, overnight, and it was done, good to go the next day. Why can't we do that? Why can't we do that?
Well, possibly repeatability. I don't know how often they have repeated that kind of a bridge replacement. Scale, you'd have contractors that would work across Europe. Here, we've got kind of bespoke New Zealand stuff.
All right. Well, we used to get things done. Interesting chat. Thank you, Eric Crampton, for coming back on. No easy answer to declining fertility rates, though the housing situation is definitely part of it, right? That's a big fix that could be made, is what I picked up from what you were saying.
That's where I would be going first, yeah.
Yeah. And as for infrastructure, well, if it's perceptions, maybe it's not entirely accurate.
but there is something real underlying it. We need to get better at it, because otherwise we won't be able to solve housing.
Mind you, we'll have less people. You never know. Dr. Eric Crampton, Chief Economist, New Zealand Initiative. Thanks for coming back on, Eric. Again, look forward to our next chat, whenever that will be.
Thanks for having me. Great chatting as always.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.